Well, I'm really happy to be talking with Prince Mashele today, political analyst and author, as you can see from his title, but he's a heck of a lot more than that, influencing a lot of the public discourse here in South Africa. And man, do we need positive influences right now? He's going to be giving us his latest thoughts on what's happening in the world. Prince, really good to see you. You've got lots of fans amongst the BizNews tribe. They love, as I do, your cultured pen. Where did you learn to write? I mean, or was it just a gift that you happened to pick up from somewhere in the family?
Thanks, Alec, for inviting me. When I was a student activist back at university, at the University of Venda, I used to belong to a student organization called SASCO, which is a student wing of the ANC. And I held different positions there, including being a branch secretary. So that's where I actually learned to write, in addition to the fact that I'm a reader. So writing goes with reading.
Tell me a little about reading, and I'll take you to what I'm thinking here. Warren Buffett says that if you want to progress in life, the first thing you got to do is read, and then when you get tired, you got to read some more. Do you have that kind of voracious appetite for books?
There is hardly a day that goes by without me reading a book. I can assure you, even on Christmas Day, I start by reading before I celebrate Christmas. And I cannot emphasize more the importance of reading in sharpening the mind. I am what I am today because of the books, many books that I have read over a lifetime. I have intellectual role models, some who are alive, others are dead. And my intellectual role models are serious thinkers and serious writers. So yeah, books are my life.
And give us a few names. I see you got Fukuyama behind you, the man who spoke about the end of history after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Well, he didn't exactly get that one right, but he had a heck of a lot of other good things that he told us.
Yeah, Fukuyama is certainly one of the most influential writers of our time, alongside Harare, Neil Ferguson. Those are the towering names of thinkers and writers of our time. And when I get attracted to a thinker or a writer, my habit is to collect all of that thinker's books and read all of them, because I want to penetrate the core of that thinker's mind. Fukuyama is one of those that I've followed since his article on the end of history. Remember, it began as an article and it developed into a book. And that's what made Fukuyama famous. But he has written a lot of books since then. I've read that. But if to share with you and I'm an eclectic reader. So I read everything from Karl Marx to Adam Smith and everything in between. But just to give you a few of my intellectual role models, Bertrand Russell, whom I'm sure you know, behind me now, there's a whole collection of his books. I've read almost all of his books except Principia Mathematica, because it's a treatise on mathematics, which I don't understand. But the rest of everything that he has written, I have read because I wanted to get into the man's mind. My second intellectual role model is a professor who is still alive, by the way. He's an old professor. He's at Harvard. Roberto Mangabeira Unga, who wrote two volumes on false necessity and many others. I can give you those two names, but I can go on and on. I've read history, economics, philosophy. In the main, those are the subjects that I follow.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us. It's often guidance that is requested by members of the BizNews tribe on books, because they say, okay, well, you tell us to read, but what exactly? And well, you've given us some a treasure chest there. Prince, in the past, you were also a speechwriter for the presidency. I say in the past because having listened to a number of the recent speeches coming out of the presidency, I would be hard-pressed to believe that you wrote them.
Definitely not. I mean, you're right, in the past, and that's a long time ago, by the way. I left, I think it was 2008. So I was part of a speech-writing team for former President Thabo Mbeki. And I'm very proud that I was part of that team. I learned a lot during that process. I mean, as you know, Thabo Mbeki is one of our best political thinkers in South Africa, I dare say. In fact, I place him side by side with Ian Smuts. There are two speeches, by the way, that, in my view, are historic in South Africa. And most South Africans may not have been aware of it. The one was by Ian Smuts, the South Africans. He presented this speech, by the way, delivered this speech to a group of foreign journalists at the time who were in South Africa. He was prime minister. But he was actually communicating to the journalists of the world the character of South Africa. What is South Africa? What makes this country tick? And the second speech would be Thabo Mbeki, I'm an African. As you can see, these speeches focus on our identity. That also, I think that speech is very, very historic. To cut a long story short, yes, I was one of the speech writers in the presidency under former President Thabo Mbeki.
How does that all work? And I ask this because there's a perception that sometimes Cyril Ramaphosa gets on the podium and reads the speech for the first time. Surely that's not possible. Surely if you're going to deliver a speech, as much as you might trust those who are writing it for you, you have to have a lot of input in it.
Yeah, look, here is how it works. There is no president in the world who can write all of his speeches. That's the bottom line. A president of a modern state on a given day would deliver maybe two or even three speeches. So you move from one event to another. So it's not possible for a president to write all of his speeches. But what thinking presidents do, they have a special interest in specific events and significant occasions, such as the State of the Nation address, or even an address to the General Assembly of the United Nations, or even a public lecture, by the way, that is important. So a thinking president would take a special interest in that. So the speech writing team would have a whole calendar of the president. The president is speaking on such and such an event, on such and such a day. And then you divide the work, you do a draft, and then there's a whole exchange within the team in terms of the drafts, back and forth. And eventually the speech closer to the date would be given to the president. And the president would go through it. And the president would say, go back. I need a quote from that book. I need a reference from a speech delivered by such and such a leader on such and such an occasion. And I want a paragraph on this and that. And then you refine it, you include that, take it back to the president. And the president eventually would have his final word on the speech and redraft it, if it's an important speech. But there are speeches that are not significant. Maybe the president is opening some event, some school somewhere, or a crash, I don't know what it is, and he's going to deliver the remarks for 5 minutes. Things like those, some presidents actually don't even worry. If they trust the team that writes for them, they know that such a team would have mastered their tone, their emphasis, their angles, and then they would take a speech like that and read before at the event, even without having seen it, say, days before. So pretty much that's how it works. With regard to President Cyril Ramaphosa, here is my sense, and I'm not saying this because I was once a speechwriter. He has a terrible team of speechwriters. Once he has delivered a speech, it's very difficult to remember after a few days. A good speech must have a clear line that will last, beyond the event. So if I were to ask you, he delivered the State of the Nation address a week or so ago. What is it? Is there a theme that we remember as South Africans that is in that State of the Nation address? I can tell you as a writer myself, I cannot remember. I can remember anecdotes here and there, but there was no theme. In other words, he never gave South Africans a direction, a line of march. So he has a poor team of speechwriters.
What about books? And I really want to get to the controversy that you were pulled into with Herman Mashaba, so we can put that one side. He wanted a biography. He was paying you for a biography. That is normal. I remember Dennis Beckett, who was one of the most independent thinkers in the world, talking to me about accepting a commission to write the biography of Brett Kebble. And we had a long conversation about it. And I suppose, fortunately, Brett Kebble passed away before Dennis wrote that book. But from that particular issue of Herman Mashaba, it's been a lot of he said, she said, and I'd love to hear your insights on this.
Yeah. Look, I smile because, to be honest, I am very proud of that book, by the way. Let me just place it on record. I am very proud of that book. Anybody who can pick up that book and read it, nobody, I can assure you, will come and tell me that that book, one, is poorly written. Number two, that is a hagiography. By the way, the publishers, Jonathan Ball, when I gave them the manuscript, they were even afraid that Herman was going to sue us because the stuff that is that in that book, some of it, it's sensitive. So I'm very proud of that book. I think it's a reflection of the highest level of my intellectual development so far, and I'm still evolving. But let me tell you the process that led to that book. And before I say this, there's a bit that I think is very important about the book. Everyone who has asked me about the controversy regarding the book, embarrassingly, has never read the book. So a lot of what people said about the book, those people who were saying whatever they said, never read the book. So, and that's the thing about South Africans. They want to talk about books they have never read. They were not interested in the book itself. They were interested in me and Masha, not the book. But let's put that aside. This is what happened. Back in 2018, Mashaba was mayor of Johannesburg. There was no Action SA at the time because people thought I was writing this to promote Action SA. There was not even an idea of Action SA in 2018, if you remember, Alec. So I'm a follower of global politics, South African politics. I see something happening in the world around 2016, 2017. I see a bunch of outsiders who were business people, comedians in Zelensky in Ukraine. In Europe, I see these outsiders who come from outside and take over the political theater. And in South Africa, I am reflecting, could it be that the future of South Africa is going in that direction? There will be, at some point, an outsider who will not come from the traditional political parties who is going to take over South African politics. That was me reflecting on my own. And then I see Herman, whom I had dismissed, by the way, before. I mean, he knows it. And everyone who knows me, they know. And I said, could it be that this Mashaba guy is going to be that outsider who will eventually take over our politics? At the time, I thought he was going to rise in the DA because now he was mayor. I never thought he was going to be mayor. And then I said, okay, but who is this Mashaba? I then went to read two of the books he had written about himself. I was not happy. They are booklets, and obviously they're not critical. They are written in a man to promote himself. Then I said, no. I need to investigate and write a book about this guy, a proper biograph, so that if it ever happens for him to take over our South African politics in line with what I'm seeing in the world, at least there would be a book that will tell the public who this guy is. That's the background. And then I began to look for his numbers and I approached him. This is 2018 when I approached him. In fact, at the time, by the way, there were not even problems, as far as I was aware, between him and the DA. I thought it was comfortable, and I thought it was going to go far in the DA. So I went to him. I said, hey, there is a phenomenon that I'm seeing in the world, this and that and that. You are of interest to me. I want to write a biography about you. And he was shocked. And there were meetings between me and him back and forth. Eventually, he accepts that I'm going to write a biograph. But then there's a second problem. The second problem is that if you write a book, you need money. Because it's going to take my time. I was going to be full-time on the other project. So I need to raise man. So I said to him, I would like you to help me raise man. The idea I had, by the way, was that he was going to write a letter of endorsement. I was going to go around raising the money myself. That's the idea I had. And then along the line, he says, hang on, what if I give you a loan? That's him. Then I said, wait a minute. No. I will not accept a loan because I'll not be able to pay it back. That's what I said to him. He said, you can pay it through royalties. Then I said to him, what if the royalties are not enough to generate the whole loan and pay you back? He said, I will not obligate you to pay me back. Then I realized that, okay, he is prepared to put in his money behind this project. And then I said, sure, on condition that this book is mine, I will have a final word. You will read it, the manuscript. You can give me your opinions on certain aspects of it. We will debate, but at the end of the day, it's my book, and this will be written in the contract. He said, agreed. I went to write the contract myself. The contract was written by myself. But then in the contract, there was a confidentiality clause. I mean, this is standard, by the way, in contracts. If, for example, you were to say you want a copy of the contract between Michael Kado and the Oppenheimer family, because he wrote a biography of Harry Oppenheimer. Let me tell you, you won't be given that contract. Yeah, there is a confidentiality clause. There was a confidentiality clause also on my part and on the part of Herman, that this contract, the contract between the two of us, will not disclose without a written permission, either by him or by me. Then I did a budget, by the way. So this whole 12.5 million, let me tell you how it worked. This was a four-year project. So I needed to hire a researcher. I needed a team, cameraman, this and that. And I was going to follow Mashaba everywhere he went, travel with him as part of that budget. So there was this 12.5 million. It's not money that came into my pocket. And there was an item, obviously, the salary of a researcher, also a salary for me. That's how I earn money. And then the whole thing started. I did not have a publisher at that stage, deliberately. Because when I write my books, I don't go to a publisher and say, I'm writing a book, let's sign a contract. I write first. Why? Because publishers, once you say, I am committing, they will have these timelines that are so tight, you have no space to move. So I finished the manuscript, and then I said, now I can approach a publisher. So then I approached Jonathan Ball first. Jonathan Ball saw the manuscript and said, Prince, this is an excellent book. They jumped at it. I said, please, we are publishing this book. They even were afraid that Mashaba would sue. I said, no, Mashaba won't sue because he has seen the manuscript. Then fast forward, we're now publishing the book. Then there's an issue of a title, unauthorized biograph. It caused a lot of stuff people who actually made a lot of noise about this, they have no idea how books are written. When you have written a book, generally the author doesn't decide the title. There is a conversation between the author and the publisher. And we had such a conversation with Jonathan Ball. I said to Jonathan Ball, I propose that the title of the book should be Herman Mashaba, the Outsider. They said, no, it won't sell. We need to say it's an unauthorized biograph. Then I explained to them that, no. Mashaba has seen this book. Here is the nature of the interaction I had with him. They still insisted we should call it an unauthorized biograph. Not me, but them. And by the way, I have this in writing. They are emails. But people were never interested in this stuff because they wanted what? They wanted to murder me, to murder my integrity. So essentially, that's what happened. I can assure you, I sleep at night. I never stole a cent. I simply had an idea. This idea was funded by Mashaba. And by the way, I thank him for that. There are very few people who are willing to put their money behind books. Mashaba was willing to put his money behind books. And as I said, read the book for yourself and tell me if it's a bad book. Let me tell you, that book has been read by more than 1,000 people before it was pulled out. Not a single person has said this is a rubbish book. In fact, people have reached out to me secretly and say, Prince, we wish this book could be read by the whole of South Africa because it's pregnant with history. If you want to learn about the history of South Africa, go and read that book. You are going to be surprised. So that's my story.
Brilliant. And I'm glad we spent a bit of time on this because Herman Mashaba appears to have become a different picture or provide a different picture to what many people thought he would be. And I'd love to get your insights into that. There was a phenomenal speech by Athol Trollope, who's Action SA's parliamentary leader, on the State of the Nation address, which he said was delusional. Athol is saying that we as Action SA are going to be the real opposition in Parliament, for instance, on the one side. But on the other hand, you've got Herman Mashaba, who is coming across as somebody who's driven by resentment and envy of the Democratic Alliance. So I'd love to get you know the guy, you've spent time with the guy, you've followed him for 4 years. What do we make of Mashaba today?
Yeah, I think, you see, in the book, by the way, the book doesn't have a conclusion on Mashaba. And the reason why it doesn't have a conclusion on Mashaba, I said there, by the words are, the player is still on the field. And that's the danger of writing a biography about someone who's still alive. Because that person actually may change. And he may evolve. You may discover things that you did not know about him later when you have written the conclusion. That's why the book said the player is still in the field. So that's important to note. Number two. That was one. I think Mashaba is not an experienced politician. He's actually not a politician. And by the way, he would say my knowledge of politics is very dangerous, referring to himself. And I write in the book that he's politically ignorant. And he admits, by the way, that he's politically ignorant. So he's learning as he goes along. Now, one of the things that I think explain the new Mashaba we are seeing is the fact that he did not understand how politics works. You see, in business, you can state your principle and you can state what you are willing to take and what you're not willing to take, and you stick to it and say, I'm rejecting the deal or I'm accepting the deal. In business, it works like that. And then you move on. In politics, you can state what you think you stand for today. But politics is so dynamic in that tomorrow a wholly new situation can present itself that forces you to change what you thought was your principle. And Mashaba did not appreciate this. So what explains the Mashaba I see today? This is my view. He has a very deep sense of betrayal. He feels that he has been betrayed very badly by the Democratic Alliance. One, he was in the DA, and when he was at Action SA. So he had ideas in terms of what the DA stood for that made him to go join the DA. When he was inside, he was deeply disappointed and he jumped out. When he formed Action SA, he still was prepared to negotiate a deal with his former party, the DA. And the culmination of that deal was the moonshot pact. And even there, he felt deeply disappointed because there is something he had negotiated, by the way, and the DA accepted it. But the DA, in my view, were not honest in accepting that principle. Mashaba said to them, if we are going to have a pact, let's have a principle that whatever happens after the elections, you will never go into a coalition arrangement with the ANC. And the DA accepted that principle. But then the DA reneged on that principle without talking to Mashaba and those who were part of the moonshot pact. And Mashaba felt deeply, deeply hurt. What did he decide to do, in my view? He decided he's going to teach the DA a lesson. So what you see in terms of his political actions in the main are driven by an intention to teach the DA a terrible lesson. So that's how I read him. And I'm not sure if that helps to explain him. But yeah, I know a bit about him because I spent long hours with him. In his house, I've followed him and so on. So I can claim that I know the man.
Do you think his project has got legs?
To be honest, no. I think he made a terrible mistake politically. The biggest mistake that he made is this. When he announced that he's forming a party, he said he was forming the party to do, in the main, one thing, to remove the ANC from power. He was very clear. That was his project. Because the ANC is corrupt, is incompetent, and all of that. And most South Africans agreed with him, by the way, agreed with his reading and his analysis of the ANC. If you remember, when the HNSA first participated in the local government municipal elections, they actually did relatively well, about 16% in Johannesburg, which was actually good. But then later on, people were now surprised when in a city like Tshwane, for example, he now goes into a coalition arrangement with the ANC. That I have interpreted from where I'm sitting, and I'm sitting from a distance, I have interpreted as him dribbling his own followers and supporters. So he left his followers and supporters confused and said, here is a man who told us he's forming a party to remove the ANC from power. And we supported him on that project. And now he is in a coalition arrangement with the ANC in a city of Tshwane. Where are we now as his followers? I think that is the biggest mistake he made. And as a result, I think voters are going to punish him. I actually don't see Action SA coming back. I mean, look at the performance of Action SA in the past national elections. It's terrible.
This is really good insights, and thank you, Prince, for that, not least because of the by-election yesterday on a different topic. You have said publicly that you think that the MK project is also a bit of a shooting star, that it's not sustainable. We saw in the first test since the GNU, I suppose, that MK party was soundly beaten by the IFP in a ward where it got 54% of the votes in the national election and it was down to 18% in yesterday's by-election. And it's not just a few people who voted, it was well over half of the people who live there who voted in that ward in KZN. Just elaborate for us, if you would, on where you see the MK party going now, because there's a lot of confusion. And I must admit, amongst many thinking South Africans, a lot of fear that we could have a Jacob Zuma back in the presidency, or if not him, one of his clones.
Okay, let's start with the by-election, because it's very important what you are saying. And it tells us something about the performance of the MK party next year in the municipal elections. Live a lie, live. You will have to come back to me and say you were wrong or you were right. You see, the MK party has an EFF problem. What is an EFF problem? The EFF, if you look at its performance when there is a municipal election, it would do well when it comes to the proportional representation component of the election. And it would do terribly bad when it comes to the constituency part of the election, meaning where you vote directly for a councillor in a ward. EFF does very badly when it comes to that. That's exactly the problem that the MK party will have. Why? Let's start with the EFF so that you explain MK. The EFF has a towering figure called Julius Malema, who is recognized. There are people who like his politics and who like his personality. Those people, when it comes to the proportional representation, the brand of the party, they vote for the EFF. But then they look at where they live in a ward and say, who do I vote for where I live? And they compare a councillor of the ANC, a councillor of the DA, and they look at a hooligan of the EFF And I said, there is no way I can be a hooligan running my ward. That is the problem. The councillors of the EFF are not trusted by communities. But communities are prepared to vote for the brand when it comes to proportional representation. That is exactly the problem of MK. Next year, the MK will do well proportionally, but it will do very badly when it comes to wards, direct ward elections. Why? The MK will not have leaders in communities who can be trusted that they can run those wards. That is my reading of the party. But let me now elevate it to the national level. The MK, if you want to see that it's not a sustainable party, and I've said this before, think of it this way. Say Jacob Zuma is run over by a bus tomorrow. He's no more. We bury him. What do you think would remain there? Let me tell you what would remain. There would be a massive fight for the top position. A massive fight. All of the people who have flocked into MK are banking that when Zuma leaves, they will take over as the leader of the party. That is what the MK is about. That's number one. Number two, the MK is a collection of scoundrels, discredited people, state capture forces. Just look at the prominent names there. You will see most of those people are the ones who played active part in state capture. And they have lost out in the ANC. And then they decided, let's go to MK, because MK is going to give them two things. Number one, potential political power. They hope and dream that one day it will be a government. Number two, immediately, it's going to address their income crisis. Because these people are now unemployed. They need salaries. So what happens? MK sends them to parliament. So your tax, Alec, and my tax, we actually feed these chaps. Yeah, that's what the MK is about. Ideologically, if I were to ask anybody who has listened to everyone at MK, what does the MK stand for? I can tell you, you would struggle to find what the MK stands for. Its Secretary General, Floyd Chibambo, come from the EFF, we know him. He calls himself a Marxist-Leninist, right? Now, he is the Secretary General of MK. Is MK a Marxist-Leninist party? Certainly not. That's not what Zuma is telling us. If you listen to Zuma, MK comes across as a feudalist, traditionalist, confused party that privileges the role of traditional leaders. That's what Zuma, in his head, that's how the party is about. That is calling for parliamentary democracy, not constitutional democracy. What parliament says, essentially what Zuma says is final. That's what he wants. So it is a bunch of confused characters, but don't underestimate them. They have a following mainly in KwaZulu-Natal, and they can actually upset the apple cart. If Zuma is still alive, he is the major drawing card for MK in 2029. I would not be surprised if MK were to touch 30%. And I've said this before. The ANC is going to decline. I think it will cross the 30% mark going downward. And I think MK, if Zuma is alive, will probably be will cross the 30% mark upwards. And that will have huge implications for our politics.
What are those implications, especially given that the ANC perhaps would embrace its former leader?
Mark my words. This is, let me give you a script of what's going to happen in the ANC, and it will link to MK. Cyril Ramaphosa is not going to finish his term as the president of South Africa. Mark my words. You could say, but this chap is mad. Where does he get this stuff from? In the first place, as a matter of fact, Cyril Ramaphosa's predecessors did not finish their term. It's now culture in the ANC that towards the end, you remove the leader. That's its culture now. They will remove him. And by the way, Cyril Ramaphosa is the weakest president of the ANC ever. Where do I get that stuff from? Post-democracy is the first president to get 40%. There's no president of the ANC who got 40%. So he is very weak in the part. So His term in the ANC ends in December 2027. Now, there will be a new leader from December 2027. And that leader will begin to campaign sometime after the elections, municipal elections next year. There will be a faction, and that faction will be an anti-GNU faction, an anti-Ramaphosa faction. That faction will eventually emerge victorious in 2027 in December, and it will have its leader. I'm not quite sure who its leader is now. Paul could be part of that, by the way. Now, when that faction wins in 2027, it will move swiftly to remove Ramaphosa as president of South Africa. And that faction will say, we are rebuilding the ANC. And to rebuild the ANC would include bringing back the MK comrades who are ANC, as well as the EFF comrades who are also ANC. That will be the slogan. And once those people do that, we are likely to have the ANC getting power back in the lower 50s, with Zuma endorsing that if he's still alive, and Malema also being part of that arrangement. We are likely to have the ANC coming back in the lower 50s. That is a likely scenario. So the GNU will last until 2027. 2028, it's going to dissolve. That's my prediction.
And the costs that the GNU partners will pay in the election, there are some who believe it's going to be like the Social Democrats in the UK, where they were virtually wiped out, that the DA is risking that future?
No, they're wrong. The DA will not disappear. The DA has a loyal voting constituency. So the overwhelming majority of white South Africans, as a solid voting bloc, they vote for the DA. They are not confused. I mean, the Freedom Farm Plus gets a small portion of that, but in the main, it's almost all whites in South Africa. They vote for the DA if you look at the numbers. That voting bloc will never change and move and vote someone else. There could be a bit here and there, actually SA getting a few of them, but I can tell you the overwhelming majority will stick with the DA. And this voting constituency, by the way, has its own political calculation. One is that the DA is a better government, and they want to be governed by a good government. And by the way, this constituency is not wrong. If you look at the governance of the DA in the Western Cape, it's actually without doubt, and I don't miss my words. It's not because I like or hate, I'm an analyst. The DA is the best government in South Africa. If you look at, take the Western Cape aside, and you look at KZN. And if you want to test, by the way, this is how I test governance. I don't use stuff in the air. I use concrete stuff. If you want to test the strength of governance in any country, go to the city center of that country. If the city center is intact, you must know governance is intact. Go to eThekwini, Durban, today. It's a shadow of its former self. You want to cry. And who did that? The African National Congress. Go to Bloemfontein, Mangaung. It's a garbage heap. Who did that? The ANC. Go to Johannesburg, city center of Johannesburg. I mean, I'm not very old, but I remember the city center of Johannesburg as a place that was clean and you wanted to go to Carlton Center. Today, it's a mess. Even Tshwane, it's a mess. So the ANC is very clear. It's an incompetent party. The DA is a competent party when it comes to governance. So the DA is not going to lose its voting constituents. But the DA is not going to grow dramatically, because its voting constituency is limited. There are a few blacks, by the way. If you look at the election results, you can see blacks and coloreds and blacks, by the way, who vote for the DA. That's what takes the DA to the lower 20s. It's colored, the colored vote, as well as the few members of the black middle class. The colored vote, the DA will retain it for a very, very long time. Why? Because the coloreds in the Western Cape are happy with the governance record of the DA. There may be a few blacks in Khayelitsha, in Nkwalanga, who are screaming on the margins. But those people are a minority in the Western Cape, for example. So I don't see the DA disappearing from our electoral field. What I don't know is which party is the party of the future, that which party is tied with the future of South Africa. The ANC is receding. Even if they were to reunite with MK and the EFF, that project wouldn't be sustainable in the long term. It would crumble at some point. In fact, by the way, at some point, they would fight themselves. Because when they were united with all of these forces, they were fighting. They would fight again. So at some point, they will have to emerge a party that will unite both blacks and whites. And that party, if it emerges, I don't know when it will emerge, it can be a party of the future. Here's the thing about South Africans, and I know now there's confusion. Afrikaners, Trump say, come to the US and so on. But here's the thing about South Africa. The majority of South Africans are reasonable and they want to come to the center. They don't believe in racial discrimination, the majority of us South Africans. They may not be making noise, but if you look at the history of our country, I can substantiate this. If you look at a party that brought blacks and whites together, in other words, the party that did the best to bring blacks and whites together in the history of this country, it's one, is the ANC. And people may say they are not aware of it, but it is actually the ANC. On the black side of things, you had black radical parties like the PAC, the AZAPO, all of the parties that said, we are for black people only. We want to drive white people to the sea. Let me tell you, historically, such parties have never succeeded. And they will never succeed. The ANC succeeded because it said South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white. That's why the ANC succeeded historically. So that's the character of South Africans. South Africans want something that will bring them together. You see, if you forget the noise that has been generated by Trump, and you forget AfriForum, and you just drive around to a small town anywhere, what you will find are black and white South Africans doing things together, working together. That is the reality of South Africa. It's not the noise that we're hearing. So, that's my long-winded answer.
No, it's a good answer as well, and certainly one that is widely, widely shared, unfortunately not by those who are power mongers or seeking more power. But Prince, your insight, you mentioned Donald Trump a moment ago, on what is going on in South Africa at the moment, the defense by South Africa of its beacon of morality or its ideologies, which has given us some really strange friends, to put it mildly, but your thoughts?
Look, here's the thing. There was a time when South Africa was governed properly after 1994. So we must not forget this, by the way. The first 15 years of democracy in South Africa were 15 years of good governance. Both black and white, we were proud of our government. When our government said something on behalf of us as a society, we were actually not embarrassed. We're not ashamed. We were behind Mandela. And to a large extent, we're behind Mbeki. The wheels got off when Zuma took over. Just things went haywire. The ANC ran mad. And the ANC is still mad as we speak. Now, these people can no longer think properly. They have forgotten their responsibility, that they have a responsibility to govern a country. Here is the thing. There is a leadership vacuum in South Africa today. A leader, whether in the form of a person who is leading a society or in the form of a political party, does this. A leader unites society. A leader does not divide society. The ANC can no longer unite South Africans. It can only divide us. So when that happens, it attracts enemies from all over the world. And when it realizes that it's under attack from all over the world, it even becomes more mad. And it looks for friends in wrong places. That's what has happened to the ANC. I mean, South Africa is a small country relative to the big powers, China, Russia, the US. We should not be entangled in the geopolitics of those powers. We shouldn't. If we had a smart leadership, we were going to focus on governing our country well so that it becomes a Singapore. It becomes a South Korea. South Korea or Singapore, as we speak, is not talking about Trump. No. They are focusing on making sure that the lives of their people progress. That's what they are focusing on. The ANC has completely lost the plot. So as a result, when you have a party that used to be the center of society exiting the center, what happens is you then get non-state actors who then see an opportunity to protect their interests, and they make friends even outside the country. So AfriForum, for example, is one such a force. You will get Operation Dudula, by the way, doing its own thing. You will have others and so on and so forth. So the problem is that the ANC has lost its plot. What Trump is doing, by the way, is not helping anyone in South Africa. He is actually complicating our situation. The Afrikaners are not going to leave and go to the US. I mean, anybody who thinks that, it's mad. Afrikaners are here to stay. They are South Africans. They are Africans. They're as South African as I am. But the problem is that now there is noise in South Africa. We are no longer united. We are pulling in different directions. And there is no one who can bring us back to the center. There is a vacuum because the ANC has left that space. That is the problem. So the elites, the people with money, the people who are educated, must now talk and say, how do we rescue our country from this madness? Because if they don't, if the elites don't, let me tell you, the masses are going to take over. And if they were to take over without responsible leadership, this whole thing is going to burn and all of us are going to be victims.
It's interesting the point you make there about the approach of Singapore and other smaller and South Korea. Even India has really played the Trump story very well. India is flourishing with its relationship with Trump, but it remains in BRICS as well. And maybe there's a lesson for South Africa on that one. But you talk about burning, you talk about the masses. What about this country going the Zimbabwe route? How high would you say that percentage is today, given that even in the past, I remember Yanni Mouton maybe 10 years ago saying he reckons no more than 10% at that point. Where are we on that scale now, in your opinion?
And I've said this before, South Africa will not end up like Zimbabwe. And you see, people are scared. And the easy reference point is Zimbabwe. This is another Zimbabwe. No. South Africa will not end up like Zimbabwe. I'm aware and I see the general decline all over. I travel in South Africa. I can see the general decline. South Africa, if it doesn't get rescued, by the way, it can be rescued, and we can talk about how it can be rescued. It will end up like a Nigeria. Nigeria is not Zimbabwe. There are huge differences between the two countries. Nigeria, by the way, is still the second largest economy on the continent. Sometimes they overtake us and be number one. And Nigeria has been a mess for many moons. And I've been to Nigeria, I know what I'm talking about. It has been a mess for many moons. But somehow, the chaos, amidst the chaos, something works. So here is the trend in South Africa. The trend is, that as we speak now, there are two states in South Africa. There are two states. There is a public state which is run by the GNU, that public state has collapsed, totally collapsed. Its hospitals have collapsed. Its schools have collapsed. Its roads are full of potholes. Anything that that public state runs has collapsed. I mean, let's tell each other the truth. Must not lie about it. But then there is a state that has been emerging over the years, and it's now very big. It's a private state. Its hospitals work. If you fall sick, Alec, you don't want to go to a public state. Maybe in the Western Cape, yes, but certainly not outside the Western Cape. You don't want to end up in a public hospital in a township. You don't want to send your children to a public school in the township. You don't want anything public. So there is a private state that works, and this private state has invested huge resources. And let me tell you, the citizens and the leaders of this private state will never allow that state to be collapsed. So that's what will mitigate against South Africa going in the direction of Zimbabwe. So if you had good leadership, that leadership would say, look at what the private state has done in South Africa. Why can't we borrow resources from that state in order for us to reinvigorate the public state? So you must say to the leaders and the citizens of the private state, South Africa belongs to all who live in it. Why can't we work together and make sure that the entire thing works? That can be done. All you need is good leadership, which we don't have now.
Is that your thesis for saving South Africa? Good leadership?
Certainly, certainly. If you look at, just look at every country that pulled itself from poverty, from backwardness and underdevelopment to the first world. Singapore, for example, Lee Kuan Yew. Without the leadership of Lee Kuan Yew, Singapore would not be what it is today. Right? President Park in South Korea. Without President Park's leadership, South Korea would not be where it is today. Look, China, Deng Xiaoping, by the way. Deng Xiaoping, after Mao died, decided to hell with this communism thing, doesn't work, left now, change course. And since then, all the leaders of China have actually moved in the direction of a market economy. And look at what China is today. It's number two in the world. Even Japan, same story, the Meiji dynasty in 1868. So there is no country anywhere in the world that has developed without leadership driving that process. So if you want to race to South Africa, you need to come up with a leadership project that will take over this country, steer it in the right direction, and make sure that we fix this country. This country can be fixed. The framework is there. The infrastructure is still there, by the way. Take Chris Hani Baragwanath in Soweto, for example. It's the biggest hospital in Africa. It doesn't have linen because of the ANC. But the infrastructure is there. So if you were to have good leadership, you can revive that hospital like nothing. Just clean the damn thing. Make sure there's a specialist there. Make sure there's medication there. Make sure you fire corrupt officials there. The thing can function. So yes, leadership, leadership, leadership.
Prince, there was a tweet from Mbalula recently showing your application to be the premier candidate for the DA, which I guess tells us that you are interested in politics. What role would you be playing in politics into the future?
Yeah, look, number one, this tweet, I've seen it. And this is the thing about it. You must go look there. And I've looked at the thing. I said, but who can believe this stuff? Why? It has an ID number there that does not even belong to me. Someone very young. I mean, you just have to be a moron to believe that kind of stuff. But of course, they've been spreading this stuff for many years. By the way, the DA is not the only party that supposedly I joined. Every party that has been formed since 1994, apparently I have joined. But here is the thing. When you have joined a political party, it's not complicated to verify. You have a membership card. I mean, that's how political parties work in South Africa. If you join a party, you have a membership card. right? Now, none of all of these people who have said have joined political parties, from COP to AHAN to Action SA, none of them has produced a membership card and say, here is a membership card belonging to Prince, number one. Number two, the day I joined politics, South Africa is a democracy. I'm not scared. I mean, you've listened to me, you've observed me. I'm not a sissy. I'm not scared. Why would I be scared to say I'm a member of this or that party? Why must my membership be announced by Mbalula? I can announce my own membership myself. Mbalula can be my spokesperson. So here is the thing. I am not a member of any political party. I was once a member of the ANC, by the way. This is not a secret. Years back. And I resigned and I left and I went into academia. I am enjoying my space of being a public intellectual. That is the role I see for myself. But here is the thing. You have a question. Would I be interested in politics? I will not dodge it. If for some reason there were to be a group of South Africans I believe in, that they want to rescue this country and they are serious and they are credible, and they say they were to come to me and say, Prince, you are a patriotic South African, help us. Let me tell you, I can say this without a doubt, I would help such a group because of whatever skill I have, if they think I can help. I can help such a group because I am a patriot. In addition to being an analyst, and more importantly, I am a father, I have children. I want my children to live in a proper country. I don't want my children to live in a Zimbabwe. So, yes, I have a stake in South African politics.
And it is rescuable. South Africa is savable, clearly.
There's no question about it. I can tell you, I have the formula. But this formula, it's not going to happen in 2029. If you want to rescue South Africa, you need to have a long-term view. And there are certain things that you need to do and say, this in 15 years, this thing will begin to turn. By the way, if you look at the ANC or the DA, all of them are where they are, the DA, because they had a long-term view. I mean, when the DA started, it was nothing. But they had a long-term view and said, this is what we're going to do. That's how politics works. The problem is that most of the people who are starting political parties in South Africa, they think they're going to win an election tomorrow and rescue South Africa. It does not work that way. This country is rescuable. If you get the right leadership, number one, that's ingredient number two. Number one. Number two, you need to focus on young leaders, both black and white, because the future belongs to them. And it has to be educated, smart, young South Africans. And these people, by the way, find them wherever they are. And they are there, I can assure you. You must nurture them and plant this idea that the leadership of this country belongs to them. And these people must be exposed to the best education and the best political and economic training, by the way. If you do so, and these people must know that they will lead this country at some point, this thing can be done. It can be rescued. Here's the thing. South Africa, by the way, today, it's actually not at its worst stage. If you know the history of this country, you will know that when the mining moguls, the landlords, laid the foundation, this thing was a bush. There was no road. There was not a road, not one railway line. They built roads. They laid the foundation. So if South Africa was worse, it was worse then because it had nothing at all. It was a bush. Again, when young smarts, beginning in 1919, when he came up with this idea of state-owned enterprises, and the first was Eskom. He invited Hendrik van der Bijl, by the way, to build Eskom. There was nothing in this country. So those people faced a more daunting challenge than us. We have roads. We have buildings. The infrastructure is there. All you need is leadership to make sure that you flush out the rotten elements who are misgoverning these cities and make sure that these cities and towns are redirected, and you invite the private sector to make more investment. This country is beautiful. I have traveled, I know. This is one of the best countries in the world, without a doubt.
Blessed by our people, cursed by our leaders, but maybe there will be a change in future. Prince Mashele, political analyst and author, and a great advert for the power of reading. It's been a privilege chatting with you today. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.